Goldfinger by Ian Fleming. Copyright 1959 by Glidrose Productions Limited. This unabridged recording of the reading of Goldfinger was published by arrangement with Ian Fleming, Glidrose Publications Limited, and was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Robert Whitfield. This book is 223 pages long. Goldfinger by Ian Fleming. This book bears a dedication to my gentle reader, William Plumer. The following material appears on the book's back cover. A friendly game of two-handed canasta that turns out thoroughly crooked, and a beautiful golden girl who ends up thoroughly dead. Bond's first encounter with Auric Goldfinger, the world's cleverest, cruelest criminal, teaches him useful lessons. Soon the game will change, and the stakes will rise to $15 billion worth of gold. But 007 knows that Goldfinger's rules remain brutally simple. Heads, I win. Tails, you die. Nobody else does this sort of thing as well as Mr. Fleming. The brilliance of the Baccarat in Casino Royale and the fantastic bridge game in Moonraker are matched here. Julian Simmons, The Sunday Times. Mr. Fleming is the best thriller writer since Buchan. Evening Standard. Goldfinger said, "Mr. Bond, they have a saying in Chicago. Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence. The third time, it's enemy action." Part 1. Happenstance. Chapter 1. Reflections in a Double Bourbon. James Bond, with two double bourbons inside him, sat in the final departure lounge of Miami Airport and thought about life and death. It was part of his profession to kill people. He had never liked doing it, and when he had to kill, he did it as well as he knew how, and forgot about it. As a secret agent who held the rare 00 prefix, the license to kill in the Secret Service, it was his duty to be as cool about death as a surgeon. If it happened, it happened. Regret was unprofessional. Worse, it was death watch beetle in the soul. And yet there had been something curiously impressive about the death of the Mexican. It wasn't that he hadn't deserved to die. He was an evil man, a man they call in Mexico a capungo. A capungo is a bandit who will kill for as little as 40 pesos, which is about 25 shillings, though probably he had been paid more to attempt the killing of Bond. And from the look of him, he had been an instrument of pain and misery all his life. Yes, it had certainly been time for him to die. But when Bond had killed him, less than 24 hours before, life had gone out of the body so quickly, so utterly, that Bond had almost seen it come out of his mouth, as it does in the shape of a bird in Haitian primitives. What an extraordinary difference there was between a body full of person and a body that was empty. Now there is someone. Now there is no one. This had been a Mexican, with a name and an address, an employment card, and perhaps a driving license. Then something had gone out of him, out of the envelope of flesh and cheap clothes, and had left him an empty paper bag waiting for the dust cart. And the difference, the thing that had gone out of the stinking Mexican bandit, was greater than all Mexico. Bond looked down at the weapon that had done it. The cutting edge of his right hand was red and swollen. It would soon show a bruise. Bond flexed the hand, kneading it with his left. He had been doing the same thing at intervals through the quick plane trip that had got him away. It was a painful process, but if he kept the circulation moving, the hand would heal more quickly. One couldn't tell how soon the weapon would be needed again. Cynicism gathered at the corners of Bond's mouth.
"National Airlines, Airline of the Stars, announces the departure of their flight NA-106 to LaGuardia Field, New York. Will all passengers please proceed to gate number 7? All aboard, please."
The tannoy switched off with an echoing click. Bond glanced at his watch. at least another 10 minutes before Transamerica would be called. He signalled to a waitress and ordered another double bourbon on the rocks. When the wide, chunky glass came, he swirled the liquor round for the ice to blunt it down and swallowed half of it. He stubbed out the butt of his cigarette and sat, his chin resting on his left hand, and gazed moodily across the twinkling tarmac to where the last half of the sun was slipping gloriously into the gulf. The death of the Mexican had been the finishing touch to a bad assignment, one of the worst, squalid, dangerous, and without any redeeming feature except that it had got him away from headquarters. A big man in Mexico had some poppy fields. The flowers were not for decoration. They were broken down for opium, which was sold quickly and comparatively cheaply by the waiters at a small café in Mexico City called the Madre de Cacao. The Madre de Cacao had plenty of protection. If you needed opium, you walked in and ordered what you wanted with your drink. You paid for your drink at the case, and the man at the case told you how many noughts to add to your bill. It was an orderly commerce of no concern to anyone outside Mexico. Then, far away in England, the government, urged on by the United Nations drive against drug smuggling, announced that heroin would be banned in Britain. There was alarm in Soho, and also among respectable doctors who wanted to save their patients' agony. Prohibition is the trigger of crime. Very soon the routine smuggling channels from China, Turkey, and Italy were run almost dry by the illicit stockpiling in England. In Mexico City, a pleasant-spoken import and export merchant called Blackwell had a sister in England who was a heroin addict. He loved her and was sorry for her, and when she wrote that she would die if someone didn't help, he believed that she wrote the truth and set about investigating the illicit dope traffic in Mexico. In due course, through friends and friends of friends, he got to the Madre de Cacao, and on from there to the big Mexican grower. In the process he came to know about the economics of the trade, and he decided that if he could make a fortune, and at the same time help suffering humanity, he had found the secret of life. Blackwell's business was in fertilizers. He had a warehouse and a small plant, and a staff of 3 for soil testing and plant research. It was easy to persuade the big Mexican that, behind this respectable front, Blackwell's team could busy itself extracting heroin from opium. Carriage to England was swiftly arranged by the Mexican. For the equivalent of £1,000 a trip, every month one of the diplomatic couriers of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs carried an extra suitcase to London. The price was reasonable. The contents of the suitcase, after the Mexican had deposited it at the Victoria Station left luggage office and had mailed the ticket to a man called Schwab, care of Books and Picks Limited WC1, were worth £20,000. Unfortunately, Schwab was a bad man, unconcerned with suffering humanity. He had the idea that if American juvenile delinquents could consume millions of dollars worth of heroin every year, so could their teddy boy and girl cousins. In 2 rooms in Pimlico, his staff watered the heroin with stomach powder and sent it on its way to the dance halls and amusement arcades. Schwab had already made a fortune when the CID Ghost Squad got on to him. Scotland Yard decided to let him make a little more money while they investigated the source of his supply. They put a close tail on Schwab, and in due course were led to Victoria Station and thence to the Mexican Courier. At that stage, since a foreign country was concerned, the Secret Service had had to be called in, and Bond was ordered to find out where the courier got his supplies and to destroy the channel at source. Bond did as he was told. He flew to Mexico City and quickly got to the Madre de Cacao. Thence, posing as a buyer for the London traffic, he got back to the big Mexican. The Mexican received him amiably and referred him to Blackwell. Bond had rather taken to Blackwell. He knew nothing about Blackwell's sister, but the man was obviously an amateur, and his bitterness about the heroin ban in England rang true. Bond broke into his warehouse one night and left a thermite bomb. He then went and sat in a café a mile away and watched the flames leap above the horizon of rooftops and listened to the silver cascade of the fire brigade bells. The next morning he telephoned Blackwell. He stretched a handkerchief across the mouthpiece and spoke through it. "Sorry you lost your business last night. I'm afraid your insurance won't cover those stocks of soil you were researching."
"Who's that? Who's speaking?"
"I'm from England. That stuff of yours has killed quite a lot of young people over there, damaged a lot of others. Santos won't be coming to England any more with his diplomatic bag.
Schwab will be in jail by tonight. That fellow Bond you've been seeing, he won't get out of the net either. The police are after him now." Frightened words came back down the line. "All right, but just don't do it again. Stick to fertilizers." Bond hung up. Blackwell wouldn't have had the wits. It was obviously the big Mexican who had seen through the false trail. Bond had taken the precaution to move his hotel, but that night, as he walked home after a last drink at the Copacabana, a man suddenly stood in his way. The man wore a dirty white linen suit and a chauffeur's white cap that was too big for his head. There were deep blue shadows under Aztec cheekbones. In one corner of the slash of a mouth there was a toothpick, and in the other a cigarette. The eyes were bright pinpricks of marijuana.
"You like a woman? Make a jig a jig?"
"No."
"Colored girl? Fine jungle tale?"
"No."
"Maybe pictures?"
The gesture of the hand slipping into the coat was so well known to Bond, so full of old dangers, that when the hand flashed out and the long silver finger went for his throat, Bond was on balance and ready for it. Almost automatically, Bond went into the parry defence against underhand thrust out of the book. His right arm cut across, his body swivelling with it. The two forearms met midway between the two bodies, banging the Mexican's knife arm off target and opening his guard for a crashing short-arm chin jab with Bond's left. Bond's stiff, locked wrist had not travelled far, perhaps 2 feet, but the heel of his palm, with fingers spread for rigidity, had come up and under the man's chin with terrific force. The blow almost lifted the man off the sidewalk. Perhaps it had been that blow that had killed the Mexican, broken his neck. But as he staggered back on his way to the ground, Bond had drawn back his right hand and slashed sideways at the taut, offered throat. It was the deadly hand-edge blow to the Adam's apple, delivered with the fingers locked into a blade, that had been the standby of the commandos. If the Mexican was still alive, he was certainly dead before he hit the ground. Bond stood for a moment, his chest heaving, and looked at the crumpled pile of cheap clothes flung down in the dust. He glanced up and down the street. There was no one. Some cars passed. Others had perhaps passed during the fight, but it had been in the shadows. Bond knelt down beside the body. There was no pulse. Already the eyes that had been so bright with marijuana were glazing. The house in which the Mexican had lived was empty. The tenant had left. Bond picked up the body and laid it against a wall in deeper shadow. He brushed his hands down his clothes, felt to see if his tie was straight, and went on to his hotel. At dawn, Bond had got up and shaved and driven to the airport, where he took the first plane out of Mexico. It happened to be going to Caracas. Bond flew to Caracas and hung about in the transit lounge until there was a plane for Miami, a Trans-America Constellation that would take him on that same evening to New York. Again the tannoy buzzed and echoed.
"Trans-America regrets to announce a delay on their flight TR-618 to New York due to a mechanical defect. The new departure time will be at 8 a.m. Will all passengers please report to the Trans-America ticket counter, where arrangements for their overnight accommodation will be made. Thank you."
So, that too. Should he transfer to another flight, or spend the night in Miami? Bond had forgotten his drink. He picked it up and, tilting his head back, swallowed the bourbon to the last drop. The ice tinkled cheerfully against his teeth. That was it. That was an idea. He would spend the night in Miami and get drunk, stinking drunk, so that he would have to be carried to bed by whatever tart he had picked up. He hadn't been drunk for years. It was high time. This extra night, thrown at him out of the blue, was a spare night, a gone night. He would put it to good purpose. It was time he let himself go. He was too tense, too introspective. What the hell was he doing, glooming about this Mexican, this Capango, who had been sent to kill him? It had been kill or get killed. Anyway, people were killing other people all the time, all over the world. People were using their motor cars to kill with. They were carrying infectious diseases around, blowing microbes in other people's faces, leaving gas jets turned on in kitchens, pumping out carbon monoxide in closed garages. How many people, for instance, were involved in manufacturing H-bombs, from the miners who mined the uranium to the shareholders who owned the mining shares? Was there any person in the world who wasn't somehow, perhaps only statistically, involved in killing his neighbour? The last light of the day had gone.
Below the indigo sky, the flare paths twinkled green and yellow and threw tiny reflections off the oily skin of the tarmac. With a shattering roar, a DC-7 hurtled down the main green lane. The windows in the transit lounge rattled softly. People got up to watch. Bond tried to read their expressions. Did they hope the plane would crash? Give them something to watch, something to talk about, something to fill their empty lives? Or did they wish it well? Which way were they willing the 60 passengers? To live or to die? Bond's lips turned down. Cut it out. Stop being so damned morbid. All this is just reaction from a dirty assignment. You're stale. Tired of having to be tough. You want a change. You've seen too much death. You want a slice of life. Easy. Soft. High. Bond was conscious of steps approaching. They stopped at his side. Bond looked up. It was a clean, rich-looking, middle-aged man. His expression was embarrassed, deprecating.
"Pardon me, but surely it's Mr. Bond. Mr., James Bond?"
Chapter 2. Living It Up. Bond liked anonymity. His, "Yes, it is," was discouraging.
"Well, that's a mighty rare coincidence."
The man held out his hand. Bond rose slowly, took the hand, and released it. The hand was pulpy and unarticulated, like a hand-shaped mud pack or an inflated rubber glove.
"My name is DuPont. Junius DuPont. I guess you won't remember me, but we've met before. Mind if I sit down?"
The face? The name? Yes, there was something familiar. Long ago. Not in America. Bond searched the files while he summed the man up. Mr. DuPont was about 50, pink, clean-shaven, and dressed in the conventional disguise with which Brooks brothers cover the shame of American millionaires. He wore a single-breasted, dark-tan tropical suit and a white silk shirt with a shallow collar. The rolled ends of the collar were joined by a gold safety pin beneath the knot of a narrow, dark red and blue striped tie that fractionally wasn't the Brigade of Guards. The cuffs of the shirt protruded half an inch below the cuffs of the coat and showed cabochon crystal links containing miniature trout flies. The socks were charcoal grey silk, and the shoes were old and polished mahogany and hinted peel. The man carried a dark, narrow-brimmed straw Homburg with a wide claret ribbon. Mr. DuPont sat down opposite Bond and produced cigarettes and a plain gold Zippo lighter. Bond noticed that he was sweating slightly. He decided that Mr. DuPont was what he appeared to be, a very rich American, mildly embarrassed. He knew he had seen him before, but he had no idea where or when.
"Smoke?"
"Thank you." It was a parliament. Bond affected not to notice the offered lighter. He disliked held-out lighters. He picked up his own and lit the cigarette.
"France, 51, Royal Leisure."
Mr. DuPont looked eagerly at Bond.
"That casino. Ethel, that's Mrs. DuPont, and me, were next to you at the table the night you had the big game with the Frenchman."
Bond's memory raced back. Yes, of course. The DuPonts had been numbers 4 and 5 at the baccarat table. Bond had been 6. They had seemed harmless people. He had been glad to have such a solid bulwark on his left on that fantastic night when he had broken Le Chiffre. Now Bond saw it all again, the bright pool of light on the green baize, the pink crab hands across the table scuttling out for the cards. He smelled the smoke and the harsh tang of his own sweat. That had been a night. Bond looked across at Mr. DuPont and smiled at the memory. "Yes, of course I remember. Sorry I was slow. But that was quite a night. I wasn't thinking of much except my cards." Mr. DuPont grinned back, happy and relieved.
"Why, gosh, Mr. Bond, of course I understand, and I do hope you'll pardon me for butting in. You see—"
He snapped his fingers for a waitress.
"But we must have a drink to celebrate. What'll you have?"
"Thanks. Bourbon on the rocks."
"And Dimple Hague and water."
The waitress went away. Mr. DuPont leant forward, beaming. A whiff of soap or aftershave lotion came across the table. Londheric?
"I knew it was you. as soon as I saw you sitting there. But I thought to myself, Junius, you don't often make an error over a face, but let's just go make sure. Well, I was flying Trans-American tonight, and when they announced the delay, I watched your expression, and if you'll pardon me, Mr. Bond, it was pretty clear from the look on your face that you had been flying Trans-American, too.
He waited for Bond to nod. He hurried on.
So I ran down to the ticket counter and had me a look at the passenger list. Sure enough, there it was. J. Bond.
Mr. DuPont sat back, pleased with his cleverness. The drinks came. He raised his glass.
Your very good health, sir. This sure is my lucky day.
Bond smiled noncommittally and drank. Mr. DuPont leant forward again. He looked round. There was nobody at the nearby tables. Nevertheless, he lowered his voice.
I guess you'll be saying to yourself, well, it's nice to see Junius DuPont again, but what's the score? Why is he so particularly happy at seeing me on just this night?
Mr. DuPont raised his eyebrows as if acting Bond's part for him. Bond put on a face of polite inquiry. Mr. DuPont leant still farther across the table.
Now, I hope you'll forgive me, Mr. Bond. It's not like me to pry into other people's secret... affairs. But after that game at Royale, I did hear that you were not only a grand card player, but also that you were, how shall I put it, that you were a sort of, investigator. You know, kind of intelligence operative.
Mr. DuPont's indiscretion had made him go very red in the face. He sat back and took out a handkerchief and wiped his forehead. He looked anxiously at Bond. Bond shrugged his shoulders. The grey-blue eyes that looked into Mr. DuPont's eyes, which had turned hard and watchful despite his embarrassment, held a mixture of candour, irony, and self-deprecation. I used to dabble in that kind of thing. Hangover from the war. One still thought it was fun, playing Red Indians, but there's no future in it in peacetime.
Quiet. Quiet.
Mr. DuPont made a throwaway gesture with the hand that held the cigarette. His eyes evaded Bond's as he put the next question, waited for the next lie. Bond thought, there's a wolf in this Brooks Brothers clothing. This is a shrewd man.
And now you've settled down?
Mr. DuPont smiled paternally.
What did you choose, if you'll pardon the question?
Import and export. I'm with Universal. Perhaps you've come across them. Mr. DuPont continued to play the game.
Universal. Let me see. Why, yes, sure, I've heard of them. Can't say I've ever done business with them, but I guess it's never too late.
He chuckled fatly.
I've got quite a heap of interests all over the place. Only stuff I can honestly say I'm not interested in is chemicals. Maybe it's my misfortune, Mr. Bond, but I'm not one of the chemical DuPonts.
Bond decided that the man was quite satisfied with a particular brand of DuPont he happened to be. He made no comment. He glanced at his watch to hurry Mr. DuPont's play of the hand. He made a note to handle his own cards carefully. Mr. DuPont had a nice, pink, kindly baby face, with a puckered, rather feminine, turned-down mouth. He looked as harmless as any of the middle-aged Americans with cameras who stand outside Buckingham Palace. But Bond sensed many tough, sharp qualities behind the fuddy-duddy facade. Mr. DuPont's sensitive eye caught Bond's glance at his watch. He consulted his own.
"My, oh my! 7 o'clock, and here I've been talking away without coming to the point. Now, see here, Mr. Bond, I've got me a problem on which I'd greatly appreciate your guidance. If you can spare me the time, and if you were counting on stopping over in Miami tonight, I'd reckon it a real favor if you'd allow me to be your host."
Mr. DuPont held up his hand.
"Now, I think I can promise to make you comfortable. So happens I own a piece of the Floridiana. Maybe you heard we opened around Christmas time. Doing a great business, I'm happy to say. Really pushing that little old fountain blue."
Mr. DuPont laughed indulgently.
"That's what we call the Fontainebleau down here. Now, what do you say, Mr. Bond? You shall have the best suite, even if it means putting some good-paying customers out on the sidewalk. And you'd be doing me a real favor."
Mr. DuPont looked imploring. Bond had already decided to accept, blind. Whatever Mr. DuPont's problem,
blackmail, gangsters, women, it would be some typical form of rich man's worry. Here was a slice of the easy life he had been asking for. Take it. Bond started to say something politely deprecating. Mr. DuPont interrupted.
Please, please, Mr. Bond. And believe me, I'm grateful. Very grateful indeed.
He snapped his fingers for the waitress. When she came, he turned away from Bond and settled the bill out of Bond's sight. Like many very rich men, he considered that showing his money, letting someone see how much he tipped, amounted to indecent exposure. He thrust his roll back into his trousers pocket, the hip pocket is not the place among the rich, and took Bond by the arm. He sensed Bond's resistance to the contact and removed his hand. They went down the stairs to the main hall.
"Now, let's just straighten out your reservation."
Mr. DuPont headed for the Transamerica ticket counter. In a few curt phrases, Mr. DuPont showed his power and efficiency in his own, his American, realm.
"Yes, Mr. DuPont. Surely, Mr. DuPont. I'll take care of that, Mr. DuPont."
Outside, a gleaming Chrysler Imperial sighed up to the curb. A tough-looking chauffeur in a biscuit-coloured uniform hurried to open the door. Bond stepped in and settled down in the soft upholstery. The interior of the car was deliciously cool, almost cold. The Trans-American representative bustled out with Bond's suitcase, handed it to the chauffeur, and, with a half-bow, went back into the terminal.
"Bill's on the beach," said Mr. DuPont to the chauffeur, and the big car slid away through the crowded parking lots and out onto the parkway.
Mr. DuPont settled back.
"Hope you like stone crabs, Mr. Bond. Ever tried them?"
Bond said he had, that he liked them very much. Mr. DuPont talked about bills on the beach, and about the relative merits of stone and Alaska crab meat, while the Chrysler Imperial sped through downtown Miami, along Biscayne Boulevard and across Biscayne Bay by the Douglas MacArthur Causeway. Bond made appropriate comments, letting himself be carried along on the gracious stream of speed and comfort and rich small talk. They drew up at a white-painted mock Regency frontage in clapboard and stucco. A scrawl of pink neon said, "Bills on the beach." While Bond got out, Mr. DuPont gave his instructions to the chauffeur. Bond heard the words,
"The Aloha Suite,"
and,
"If there's any trouble, tell Mr. Fairley to call me here, right?"
They went up the steps. Inside, the big room was decorated in white, with pink muslin swags over the windows. There were pink lights on the tables. The restaurant was crowded with sunburned people in expensive tropical get-ups, brilliant garish shirts, jangling gold bangles, dark glasses with jewelled rims, cute native straw hats. There was a confusion of scents. The wry smell of bodies that had been all day in the sun came through. Bill, a pansified Italian, hurried towards them.
"Why, Mr. DuPont, it is a pleasure, sir. Little crowded tonight. Soon fix you up. Please, this way, please."
Holding a large leather-bound menu above his head, the man weaved his way between the diners to the best table in the room, a corner table for six. He pulled out two chairs, snapped his fingers for the maître d'hôtel and the wine waiter, spread two menus in front of them, exchanged compliments with Mr. DuPont, and left them. Mr. DuPont slapped his menu shut. He said to Bond,
"Now, why don't you just leave this to me? If there's anything you don't like, send it back."
And to the head waiter,
"Stone crabs, not frozen, fresh, melted butter, thick toast, right?"
"Very good, Mr. DuPont."
The wine waiter, washing his hands, took the waiter's place.
"Two pints of pink champagne, the Pommery 50, silver tankards, right?" "Very good, Mr. DuPont. A cocktail to start?"
Mr. DuPont turned to Bond. He smiled and raised his eyebrows. Bond said, "Vodka martini, please, with a slice of lemon peel."
"Make it two," said Mr. DuPont. "Doubles."
The wine waiter hurried off. Mr. DuPont sat back and produced his cigarettes and lighter. He looked round the room, answered one or two waves with a smile and a lift of the hand, and glanced at the neighbouring tables. He edged his chair nearer to Bond's.
"Can't help the noise, I'm afraid," he said apologetically. "Only come here for the crabs. They're out of this world. Hope you're not allergic to them. Once brought a girl here and fed her crabs, and her lips swelled up like cycle tires."
Bond was amused at the change in Mr. DuPont.
this racy talk, the authority of manner once Mr. DuPont thought he had got Bond on the hook, on his payroll. He was a different man from the shy, embarrassed suitor who had solicited Bond at the airport. What did Mr. DuPont want from Bond? It would be coming any minute now. The proposition. Bond said, "I haven't got any allergies."
"Good, good."
There was a pause. Mr. DuPont snapped the lid of his lighter up and down several times. He realized he was making an irritating noise and pushed it away from him. He made up his mind. He said, speaking at his hands on the table in front of him,
"You ever play canasta, Mr. Bond?"
"Yes, it's a good game. I like it."
"Two-handed canasta?"
"I have done. It's not so much fun. If you don't make a fool of yourself, if neither of you do, it tends to even out. Law of averages in the cards, no chance of making much difference in the play." Mr. DuPont nodded emphatically.
"Just so. That's what I've said to myself. Over 100 games or so, two equal players will end up equal. Not such a good game as gin or Oklahoma, but in a way that's just what I like about it. You pass the time, you handle plenty of cards, you have your ups and downs, no one gets hurt. Right?"
Bond nodded. The martinis came. Mr. DuPont said to the wine waiter,
"Bring two more in 10 minutes.
They drank. Mr. DuPont turned and faced Bond. His face was petulant, crumpled. He said,
"What would you say, Mr. Bond, if I told you I'd lost $25,000 in a week playing two-handed canasta?"
Bond was about to reply. Mr. DuPont held up his hand.
"And mark you, I'm a good card player, member of the Regency Club. Play a lot with people like Charlie Gorin, Johnny Crawford, at bridge, that is. But what I mean, I know my way around at the card table."
Mr. DuPont probed Bond's eyes. "If you've been playing with the same man all the time, you've been cheated."
"Exactly."
Mr. DuPont slapped the tablecloth. He sat back.
"Exactly. That's what I said to myself after I lost. Lost for 4 whole days. So I said to myself, this bastard is cheating me. And by golly, I'll find out how he does it and have him hounded out of Miami. So I doubled the stakes and then doubled them again. He was quite happy about it. And I watched every card he played, every movement. Nothing. Not a hint or a sign. Cards not marked. New pack whenever I wanted one. My own cards. Never looked at my hand. Couldn't, as I always sat dead opposite him. No kibitzer to tip him off. And he just went on winning and winning. Won again this morning. And again this afternoon. Finally, I got so mad at the game, I didn't show it, mind you.
Bond might think he had not been a sport.
I paid up politely, but without telling this guy, I just packed my bag and got me to the airport, and booked on the first plane to New York. Think of that."
Mr. DuPont threw up his hands.
"Running away. But 25 grand is 25 grand. I could see it getting to 50, 100. And I just couldn't stand another of these damned games, and I couldn't stand not being able to catch this guy out. So I took off. What do you think of that? Me, Junius DuPont, throwing in the towel because I couldn't take the licking any more."
Bond grunted sympathetically. The second round of drinks came. Bond was mildly interested. He was always interested in anything to do with cards. He could see the scene. The two men playing and playing, and the one man quietly shuffling and dealing away and marking up his score, while the other was always throwing his cards into the middle of the table with a gesture of controlled disgust. Mr. DuPont was obviously being cheated. How? Bond said, "25,000's a lot of money. What stakes were you playing?" Mr. DuPont looked sheepish.
"Quarter a point, then 50 cents, then a dollar. Pretty high, I guess, with the games averaging around 2,000 points. Even at a quarter, that makes $500 a game. At a dollar a point, if you go on losing, it's murder."
"You must have won sometimes."
"Oh, sure, but somehow, just as I'd got the SOB all set for a killing, he put down as many of his cards as he could meld. Got out of the bag. Sure, I won some small change, but only when he needed 120 to go down and I'd got all the wild cards. But you know how it is with canasta. You have to discard right. You lay traps to make the other guy hand you the pack. Well, darn it,
He seemed to be psychic. Whenever I laid a trap, he'd dodge it, and almost every time he laid one for me, I'd fall into it. As for giving me the pack, why, he'd choose the damnedest cards when he was pushed, discard singletons, aces, God knows what, and always get away with it. It was just as if he knew every card in my hand.
Any mirrors in the room?
Heck no, he always played outdoors. He said he wanted to get himself a sunburn. Certainly did that, red as a lobster. He'd only play in the mornings and afternoons. Said if he played in the evening, he couldn't get to sleep.
Who is this man, anyway? What's his name?
Goldfinger.
First name?
Auric. That means golden, doesn't it? He certainly is that. Got flaming red hair.
Nationality?
You won't believe it, but he's a Britisher. Domiciled in Nassau. You'd think he'd be a Jew from the name, but he doesn't look it. We're restricted to the Floridiana. Wouldn't have got in if he had been. Nassavian passport. Age 42, unmarried, profession, broker. Got all this from his passport. Had me a peek via the house detective when I started to play with him.
What sort of broker? DuPont smiled grimly.
I asked him. He said, oh, anything that comes along. Evasive sort of fellow. Clams up if you ask him a direct question. Talks away quite pleasantly about nothing at all.
What's he worth?
Ha! Said Mr. DuPont explosively. That's the damnedest thing. He's loaded, but loaded. I got my bank to check with Nassau. He's lousy with it. Millionaires are a dime a dozen in Nassau, but he's rated either first or second among them. Seems he keeps his money in gold bars. Shifts them around the world a lot to get the benefit of changes in the gold price. Acts like a damn federal bank. Doesn't trust currencies. Can't say he's wrong in that. Seeing how he's one of the richest men in the world, there must be something to his system. But the point is, if he's as rich as that, what the hell does he want to take a lousy 25 grand off me for?
A bustle of waiters round their table saved Bond having to think up a reply. With ceremony, a wide silver dish of crabs, big ones, their shells and claws broken, was placed in the middle of the table. A silver sauce-boat brimming with melted butter and a long rack of toast was put beside each of their plates. The tankards of champagne frothed pink. Finally, with an oily smirk, the head waiter came behind their chairs and, in turn, tied round their necks long white silken bibs that reached down to the lap. Bond was reminded of Charles Laughton playing Henry VIII. But neither Mr. DuPont nor the neighbouring diners seemed surprised at the hoggish display. Mr. DuPont, with a gleeful, "Every man for himself!" raked several hunks of crab onto his plate, doused them liberally in melted butter, and dug in. Bond followed suit and proceeded to eat, or rather devour, the most delicious meal he had had in his life. The meat of the stone crabs was the tenderest, sweetest shellfish he had ever tasted. It was perfectly set off by the dry toast and slightly burned taste of the melted butter. The champagne seemed to have the faintest scent of strawberries. It was ice cold. After each helping of crab, the champagne cleaned the palate for the next. They ate steadily and with absorption, and hardly exchanged a word until the dish was cleared. With a slight belch, Mr. DuPont for the last time wiped butter off his chin with his silken bib and sat back. His face was flushed. He looked proudly at Bond. He said reverently,
"Mr. Bond, I doubt if anywhere in the world a man has eaten as good a dinner as that tonight. What do you say?"
Bond thought, "I asked for the easy life, the rich life. How do I like it? How do I like eating like a pig and hearing remarks like that?" Suddenly the idea of ever having another meal like this, or indeed any other meal with Mr. DuPont, revolted him. He felt momentarily ashamed of his disgust. He had asked, and it had been given. It was the Puritan in him that couldn't take it. He had made his wish, and the wish had not only been granted, it had been stuffed down his throat. Bond said, "I don't know about that, but it was certainly very good." Mr. DuPont was satisfied. He called for coffee. Bond refused the offer of cigars or liqueurs. He lit a cigarette and waited with interest for the catch to be presented. He knew there would be one. It was obvious that all this was part of the come-on. Well, let it come. Mr. DuPont cleared his throat.
"And now, Mr. Bond, I have a proposition to put to you."
He stared at Bond, trying to gauge his reaction in advance.
Yes?
It surely was providential to meet you like that at the airport.
Mr. DuPont's voice was grave, sincere.
I've never forgotten our first meeting at Royale. I recall every detail of it. Your coolness, your daring, your handling of the cards.
Bond looked down at the tablecloth, but Mr. DuPont had got tired of his peroration. He said hurriedly,
"Mr. Bond, I will pay you $10,000 to stay here as my guest until you have discovered how this man Goldfinger beats me at cards."
Bond looked Mr. DuPont in the eye. He said, "That's a handsome offer, Mr. DuPont, but I have to get back to London. I must be in New York to catch my plane within 48 hours. If you will play your usual sessions tomorrow morning and afternoon, I should have plenty of time to find out the answer, but I must leave tomorrow night, whether I can help you or not. Done?"
"Done," said Mr. DuPont.
Chapter 3. The Man with Agoraphobia. The flapping of the curtains wakened Bond. He threw off the single sheet and walked across the thick pile carpet to the picture window that filled the whole of one wall. He drew back the curtains and went out onto the sun-filled balcony. The black-and-white checkerboard tiles were warm, almost hot to the feet, although it could not yet be 8 o'clock. A brisk inshore breeze was blowing off the sea, straining the flags of all nations that flew along the pier of the private yacht basin. The breeze was humid and smelt strongly of the sea. Bond guessed it was the breeze that the visitors like, but the residents hate. It would rust the metal fittings in their homes, fox the pages of their books, rot their wallpaper and pictures, breed damp rot in their clothes. 12 stories down the formal gardens, dotted with palm trees and beds of bright croton, and traced with neat gravel walks between avenues of bougainvillea, were rich and dull. Gardeners were working, raking the paths, and picking up leaves with the lethargic slow motion of coloured help. 2 mowers were at work on the lawns, and where they had already been, sprinklers were gracefully flinging handfuls of spray. Directly below Bond, the elegant curve of the Cabana Club swept down to the beach, 2 stories of changing rooms below a flat roof dotted with chairs and tables, and an occasional red-and-white striped umbrella. Within the curve was the brilliant green oblong of the Olympic-length swimming pool, fringed on all sides by row upon row of mattressed steamer chairs, on which the customers would soon be getting their $50-a-day sunburn. White-jacketed men were working among them, straightening the lines of chairs, turning the mattresses, and sweeping up yesterday's cigarette butts. Beyond was the long golden beach, and the sea, and more men, raking the tide-line, putting up the umbrellas, laying out mattresses. No wonder the neat card inside Bond's wardrobe had said that the cost of the Aloha suite was $200 a day. Bond made a rough calculation. If he was paying the bill, it would take him just 3 weeks to spend his whole salary for the year. Bond smiled cheerfully to himself. He went back into the bedroom, picked up the telephone, and ordered himself a delicious, wasteful breakfast— a carton of king-size Chesterfields, and the newspapers. By the time he had shaved and had an ice-cold shower and dressed, it was 8 o'clock. He walked through into the elegant sitting-room and found a waiter in a uniform of plum and gold laying out his breakfast beside the window. Bond glanced at the Miami Herald. The front page was devoted to yesterday's failure of an American ICBM at the nearby Cape Canaveral, and a bad upset in a big race at Hialeah. Bond dropped the paper on the floor and sat down and slowly ate his breakfast and thought about Mr. DuPont and Mr. Goldfinger. His thoughts were inconclusive. Mr. DuPont was either a much worse player than he thought, which seemed unlikely on Bond's reading of his tough, shrewd character, or else Goldfinger was a cheat. If Goldfinger cheated at cards, although he didn't need the money, it was certain that he had also made himself rich by cheating or sharp practice on a much bigger scale. Bond was interested in big crooks. He looked forward to his first sight of Goldfinger. He also looked forward to penetrating Goldfinger's highly successful and, on the face of it, highly mysterious method of fleecing Mr. DuPont. It was going to be a most entertaining day. Idly, Bond waited for it to get under way. The plan was that he would meet Mr. DuPont in the garden at 10 o'clock. The story would be that Bond had flown down from New York to try and sell Mr. DuPont a block of shares from an English holding in a Canadian natural gas property. The matter was clearly confidential, and Goldfinger would not think of questioning Bond about details. Shares, natural gas, Canada. That was all Bond needed to remember. They would go along together to the roof of the Cabana Club, where the game was played, and Bond would read his paper and watch. After luncheon, during which Bond and Mr. DuPont would discuss their business, there would be the same routine. Mr. DuPont had inquired if there was anything else he could arrange. Bond had asked for the number of Mr. Goldfinger's suite and a passkey. He had explained that if Goldfinger was any kind of a professional card sharp, or even an expert amateur, he would travel with the usual tools of the trade, marked and shaved cards, the apparatus for the short-arm delivery, and so forth. Mr. DuPont had said he would give Bond the key when they met in the garden. He would have no difficulty getting one from the manager. After breakfast, Bond relaxed and gazed into the middle distance of the sea. He was not keyed up by the job on hand, only interested and amused. It was just the kind of job he had needed to clear his palate after Mexico. At 9:30, Bond left his suite and wandered along the corridors of his floor, getting lost on his way to the elevator in order to reconnoitre the layout of the hotel. Then, having met the same maid twice, he asked his way and went down in the elevator and moved among the scattering of early risers through the Pineapple shopping arcade. He glanced into the bamboo coffee shop, the Rendezvous bar, the La Tropicala dining room, the Kitty Cat Club for children, and the Boom Boom Nightery. He then went purposefully out into the garden. Mr. DuPont, now dressed for the beach by Abercrombie and Fitch, gave him the passkey to Goldfinger's suite. They sauntered over to the Cabana Club and climbed the two short flights of stairs to the top deck. Bond's first view of Mr. Goldfinger was startling. At the far corner of the roof, just below the cliff of the hotel, a man was lying back with his legs up on a steamer chair. He was wearing nothing but a yellow satin bikini slip, dark glasses, and a pair of wide tin wings under his chin. The wings, which appeared to fit round his neck, stretched out across his shoulders and beyond them, and then curved up slightly to rounded tips. Bond said, "What the hell's he wearing round his neck?"
"You never seen one of those?" Mr. DuPont was surprised. "That's a gadget to help your tan. Polished tin. Reflects the sun up under your chin and behind the ears, the bits that would normally catch the sun."
"Well, well," said Bond. When they were a few yards from the reclining figure, Mr. DuPont called out cheerfully, in what seemed to Bond an over-loud voice,
"Hi there!"
Mr. Goldfinger did not stir. Mr. DuPont said in his normal voice,
"He's very deaf."
They were now at Mr. Goldfinger's feet. Mr. DuPont repeated his hail. Mr. Goldfinger sat up sharply. He removed his dark glasses.
"Why, hello there!"
He unhitched the wings from round his neck, put them carefully on the ground beside him, and got heavily to his feet. He looked at Bond with slow, inquiring eyes.
"Like you to meet Mr. Bond, James Bond, friend of mine from New York, countryman of yours. Come down to try and talk me into a bit of business."
Mr. Goldfinger held out a hand.
"Pleased to meet you, Mr. Bomb."
Bond took the hand. It was hard and dry. There was the briefest pressure, and it was withdrawn. For an instant, Mr. Goldfinger's pale, china-blue eyes opened wide and stared hard at Bond. They stared right through his face to the back of his skull. Then the lids drooped, the shutter closed over the X-ray, and Mr. Goldfinger took the exposed plate and slipped it away in his filing system.
"So, no game today?"
The voice was flat, colourless. The words were more of a statement than a question.
"What do you mean, no game?" shouted Mr. DuPont boisterously. "You weren't thinking I'd let you hang on to my money. Got to get it back, or I shan't be able to leave this darn hotel."
Mr. DuPont chuckled richly.
"I'll tell Sam to fix the table. James here says he doesn't know much about cards, and he'd like to learn the game. That right, James?"
He turned to Bond.
"Sure you'll be all right with your paper and the sunshine?"
"I'd be glad of the rest," said Bond. "Been travelling too much." Again the eyes bored into Bond and then drooped.
"I'll get some clothes on, I had intended to have a golf lesson this afternoon from Mr. Armour at the Boca Raton, but cards have priority among my hobbies. My tendency to uncock the wrists too early with the mid-irons will have to wait."
The eyes rested incuriously on Bond.
"You play golf, Mr. Baum?"
Bond raised his voice. "Occasionally, when I'm in England."
"And where do you play?"
"Huntercombe."
"Ah, a pleasant little course. I have recently joined the Royal St. Mark's. Sandwich is close to one of my business interests. You know it?"
"I have played there."
"What is your handicap?"
9.
"That is a coincidence. So is mine. We must have a game one day."
Mr. Goldfinger bent down and picked up his tin wings. He said to Mr. DuPont,
"I will be with you in 5 minutes.
He walked slowly off towards the stairs. Bond was amused. This social sniffing at him had been done with just the right casual touch of the tycoon who didn't really care if Bond was alive or dead, but, since he was there and alive, might as well place him in an approximate category. Mr. DuPont gave instructions to a steward in a white coat. Two others were already setting up a card table. Bond walked to the rail that surrounded the roof and looked down into the garden, reflecting on Mr. Goldfinger. He was impressed. Mr. Goldfinger was one of the most relaxed men Bond had ever met. It showed in the economy of his movement, of his speech, of his expressions. Mr. Goldfinger wasted no effort, yet there was something coiled, compressed, in the immobility of the man. When Goldfinger had stood up, the first thing that had struck Bond was that everything was out of proportion. Goldfinger was short, not more than 5 feet tall, and on top of the thick body and blunt peasant legs was set almost directly into the shoulders a huge and, it seemed, exactly round head. It was as if Goldfinger had been put together with bits of other people's bodies. Nothing seemed to belong. Perhaps, Bond thought, it was to conceal his ugliness that Goldfinger made such a fetish of sunburn. Without the red-brown camouflage, the pale body would be grotesque. The face, under the cliff of crew-cut carroty hair, was as startling, without being as ugly, as the body. It was moon-shaped, without being moon-like. The forehead was fine and high, and the thin, sandy brows were level above the large, light-blue eyes, fringed with pale lashes. The nose was fleshily aquiline, between high cheekbones and cheeks that were more muscular than fat. The mouth was thin and dead straight, but beautifully drawn. The chin and jaws were firm and glinted with health. To sum up, thought Bond, it was the face of a thinker, perhaps a scientist, who was ruthless, sensual, stoical, and tough. An odd combination. What else could he guess? Bond always mistrusted short men. They grew up from childhood with an inferiority complex. All their lives they would strive to be big, bigger than the others who had teased them as a child. Napoleon had been short, and Hitler. It was the short men that caused all the trouble in the world. And what about a misshapen short man with red hair and a bizarre face? That might add up to a really formidable misfit. One could certainly feel the repressions. There was a powerhouse of vitality humming in the man that suggested that if one stuck an electric bulb into Goldfinger's mouth, it would light up. Bond smiled at the thought. Into what channels did Goldfinger release his vital force? Into getting rich? Into sex? Into power? Probably into all three. What could his history be? Today he might be an Englishman. What had he been born? Not a Jew, though there might be Jewish blood in him. Not a Latin or anything farther south. Not a Slav. Perhaps a German. No, a Balt. That's where he would have come from, one of the old Baltic provinces. Probably got away to escape the Russians. Goldfinger would have been warned, or his parents had smelled trouble and they had got him out in time. And what had happened then? How had he worked his way up to being one of the richest men in the world? One day it might be interesting to find out. For the time being, it would be enough to find out how he won at cards.
"All set!"
Mr. DuPont called to Goldfinger, who was coming across the roof towards the card table. With his clothes on, a comfortably fitting dark blue suit, a white shirt open at the neck, Goldfinger cut an almost passable figure. but there was no disguise for the great brown and red football of a head, and the flesh-coloured hearing aid plugged into the left ear was not an improvement. Mr. DuPont sat with his back to the hotel. Goldfinger took the seat opposite and cut the cards. DuPont won the cut, pushed the other pack over to Goldfinger, tapped them to show they were already shuffled, and he couldn't bother to cut, and Goldfinger began the deal. Bond sauntered over and took a chair at Mr. DuPont's elbow. He sat back, relaxed. He made a show of folding his paper to the sports page and watched the deal. Somehow Bond had expected it, but this was no card sharp. Goldfinger dealt quickly and efficiently, but with no hint of the mechanic's grip, those vital three fingers curled round the long edge of the cards, and the index finger at the outside short upper edge, the grip that means you are armed for dealing bottoms or seconds. And he wore no signet ring for pricking the cards, no surgical tape round a finger for marking them. Mr. DuPont turned to Bond.
"Deal of 15 cards, he commented. "You draw two and discard one. Otherwise, straight Regency rules. No monkey business with the red trays counting 1, 3, 5, 8, or any of that European stuff."
Mr. DuPont picked up his cards. Bond noticed that he sorted them expertly, not grading them according to value from left to right, or holding his wild cards, of which he had two at the left, a pattern that might help a watchful opponent. Mr. DuPont concentrated his good cards in the centre of his hand, with the singletons and broken melds on either side. The game began. Mr. DuPont drew first, a miraculous pair of wild cards. His face betrayed nothing. He discarded casually. He only needed two more good draws to go out unseen. But he would have to be lucky. Drawing two cards doubles the chance of picking up what you want, but it also doubles the chance of picking up useless cards that will only clutter up your hand. Goldfinger played a more deliberate game, almost irritatingly slow. After drawing, he shuffled through his cards again and again before deciding on his discard. On the third draw, DuPont had improved his hand to the extent that he now needed only one of 5 cards to go down and out, and catch his opponent with a handful of cards which would all count against him. As if Goldfinger knew the danger he was in, he went down for 50. And proceeded to make a canasta with 3 wild cards and 4 fives. He also got rid of some more melds, and ended with only 4 cards in his hand. In any other circumstances, it would have been ridiculously bad play. As it was, he had made some 400 points instead of losing over 100, for on the next draw Mr. DuPont filled his hand and, with most of the edge taken off his triumph by Goldfinger's escape, went down unseen with the necessary 2 canastas.
"By golly, I nearly screwed you that time."
Mr. DuPont's voice had an edge of exasperation.
"What in hell told you to cut and run?"
Goldfinger said indifferently,
"I smelled trouble."
He added up his points, announced them, and jotted them down, waiting for Mr. DuPont to do the same. Then he cut the cards and sat back and regarded Bond with polite interest.
"Will you be staying long, Mr. Baum?"
Bond smiled. "It's Bond. B-O-N-D. No, I have to go back to New York tonight."
"How sad."
Goldfinger's mouth pursed in polite regret. He turned back to the cards and the game went on. Bond picked up his paper and gazed unseeing at the baseball scores while he listened to the quiet routine of the game. Goldfinger won that hand, and the next, and the next. He won the game. There was a difference of 1,500 points. $1,500 to Goldfinger.
"There goes again."
It was the plaintive voice of Mr. DuPont. Bond put down his paper. "Does he usually win?"
"Usually?"
The word was a snort.
"He always wins."
They cut again, and Goldfinger began to deal. Bond said, "Don't you cut for seats? I often find a change of seats helps the luck. Hostage to fortune, and so on." Goldfinger paused in his deal. He bent his gaze gravely on Bond.
"Unfortunately, Mr. Bond, that is not possible, or I could not play. As I explained to Mr. DuPont at our first game, I suffer from an obscure complaint, agoraphobia, the fear of open spaces. I cannot bear the open horizon.
I must sit and face the hotel.
The deal continued. Oh, I'm so sorry. Bond's voice was grave, interested. That's a very rare disability. I've always been able to understand claustrophobia, but not the other way round. How did it come about? Goldfinger picked up his cards and began to arrange his hand.
I have no idea, he said equably.
Bond got up. Well, I think I'll stretch my legs for a bit, see what's going on in the pool.
You do just that, said Mr. DuPont jovially. Just take it easy, James. Plenty of time to discuss business over lunch. I'll see if I can't dish it out to my friend Goldfinger this time instead of taking it. Be seeing you.
Goldfinger didn't look up from his cards. Bond strolled down the roof, past the occasional splayed-out body, to the rail at the far end that overlooked the pool. For a time he stood and contemplated the ranks of pink and brown and white flesh laid out below him on the steamer chairs. The heavy scent of suntan oil came up to him. There were a few children and young people in the pool. A man, obviously a professional diver, perhaps the swimming instructor, stood on the high dive. He balanced on the balls of his feet, a muscled Greek god with golden hair. He bounced once, casually, and flew off and down, his arms held out like wings. Lazily they arrowed out to cleave the water for the body to pass through. The impact left only a brief turbulence. The diver jackknifed up again, shaking his head boyishly. There was a smattering of applause. The man trudged slowly down the pool, his head submerged, his shoulders moving with casual power. Bond thought, "Good luck to you. You won't be able to keep this up for more than another 5 or 6 years." High divers couldn't take it for long, the repeated shock to the skull. With ski jumping, which had the same shattering effect on the frame, high diving was the shortest-lived sport. Bond radioed to the diver, "Cash in quick. Get into films while the hair's still gold." Bond turned and looked back down the roof towards the two canasta players beneath the cliff of the hotel. So Goldfinger liked to face the hotel. Or was it that he liked Mr. DuPont to have his back to it? And why? Now, what was the number of Goldfinger's suite? Number 200, the Hawaii suite. Bond's, on the top floor, was 1200. So, all things being equal, Goldfinger's would be directly below Bond's on the second floor, 20 yards or so above the roof of the Cabana Club, 20 yards from the card table. Bond counted down. He closely examined the frontage that should be Goldfinger's. Nothing. An empty sun balcony. An open door into the dark interior of the suite. Bond measured distances. Angles. Yes. That's how it might be. That's how it must be. Clever Mr. Goldfinger. Chapter 4. Over the Barrel. After luncheon, the traditional shrimp cocktail, native snapper with a minute paper cup of tartar sauce, roast prime ribs of beef au jus, and pineapple surprise, it was time for the siesta before meeting Goldfinger at 3 o'clock for the afternoon session. Mr. DuPont, who had lost a further $10,000 or more, confirmed that Goldfinger had a secretary.
"Never seen her. Sticks to the suite. Probably just some Corrine he's brought down for the ride." He smiled wetly. "I mean the daily ride. Why, you onto something?"
Bond was non-committal. "Can't tell yet. I probably won't be coming down this afternoon. Say I got bored watching, gone into the town." He paused. "But if my idea's right, don't be surprised at what may happen. If Goldfinger starts to behave oddly, just sit quiet and watch. I'm not promising anything. I think I've got him, but I may be wrong." Mr. DuPont was enthusiastic.
"Good for you, Boyle," he said effusively. "I just can't wait to see that bastard over the barrel. Damn his eyes!"
Bond took the elevator up to his suite. He went to his suitcase and extracted an M3 Leica, an MC exposure meter, a K2 filter, and a flash holder. He put a bulb in the holder and checked the camera. He went to his balcony, glanced at the sun to estimate where it would be at about 3:30, and went back into the sitting room, leaving the door to the balcony open. He stood at the balcony door and aimed the exposure meter. The exposure was 1/100th of a second. He set this on the Leica, put the shutter at f11, and the distance at 12 feet. He clipped on a lens hood and took one picture to see that all was working. Then he wound on the film, slipped in the flash holder, and put the camera aside. Bond went to his suitcase again and took out a thick book, The Bible Designed to be Read as Literature, opened it, and extracted his Walter PPK in the Burns Martin holster. He slipped the holster inside his trouser band to the left. He tried one or two quick draws. They were satisfactory. He closely examined the geography of his suite, on the assumption that it would be exactly similar to the Hawaii. He visualized the scene that would almost certainly greet him when he came through the door of the suite downstairs. He tried his passkey in the various locks and practiced opening the doors noiselessly. Then he pulled a comfortable chair in front of the open balcony door and sat and smoked a cigarette, while he gazed out across the sea and thought of how he would put things to Goldfinger when the time came. At 3:15, Bond got up and went out onto the balcony and cautiously looked down at the two tiny figures across the square of green baize. He went back into the room and checked the exposure meter on the Leica. The light was the same. He slipped on the coat of his dark blue tropical worsted suit, straightened his tie, and slung the strap of the Leica round his neck so that the camera hung at his chest. Then, with a last look round, he went out and along to the elevator. He rode down to the ground floor and examined the shop windows in the foyer. When the elevator had gone up again, he walked to the staircase and slowly climbed up two floors. The geography of the second floor was identical with the 12th. Room 200 was where he had expected it to be. There was no one in sight. He took out his pass key and silently opened the door and closed it behind him. In the small lobby, a raincoat, a light camel hair coat, and a pale grey Homburg hung on hooks. Bond took his Leica firmly in his right hand, held it up close to his face, and gently tried the door to the sitting room. It was not locked. Bond eased it open. Even before he could see what he expected to see, he could hear the voice. It was a low, attractive girl's voice, an English voice. It was saying, "Drew 5 and 4. Completed canasta in 5s with 2 2s. Discarding 4. Has singletons in kings, knaves, 9s, 7s. Bond slid into the room. The girl was sitting on 2 cushions on top of a table, which had been pulled up a yard inside the open balcony door. She had needed the cushions to give her height. It was at the top of the afternoon heat, and she was naked, except for a black brassiere and black silk briefs. She was swinging her legs in a bored fashion. She had just finished painting the nails on her left hand. Now she stretched the hand out in front of her to examine the effect. She brought the hand back close to her lips and blew on the nails. Her right hand reached sideways and put the brush back in the Revlon bottle on the table beside her. A few inches from her eyes were the eyepieces of a powerful-looking pair of binoculars, supported on a tripod whose feet reached down between her sunburned legs to the floor. Jutting out from below the binoculars was a microphone from which wires led to a box about the size of a portable record player under the table. Other wires ran from the box to a gleaming indoor aerial on the sideboard against the wall. The briefs tightened as she leant forward again and put her eyes to the binoculars. "Drew a queen and a king. Meld of queens. Can meld kings with a joker. Discarding 7. She switched off the microphone. While she was concentrating, Bond stepped swiftly across the floor until he was almost behind her. There was a chair. He stood on it, praying it wouldn't squeak. Now he had the height to get the whole scene in focus. He put his eye to the viewfinder. Yes, there it was, all in line, the girl's head, the edge of the binoculars, the microphone, and 20 yards below, the 2 men at the table, with Mr. DuPont's hand of cards held in front of him. Bond could distinguish the reds and the blacks. He pressed the button. The sharp explosion of the bulb and the blinding flash of light forced a quick scream out of the girl. She swiveled round. Bond stepped down off the chair. "Good afternoon."
"Who are you? What do you want?"
The girl's hand was up to her mouth. Her eyes screamed at him. "I've got what I want. Don't worry, it's all over now. And my name's Bond. James Bond." Bond put his camera carefully down on the chair and came and stood in the radius of her scent. She was very beautiful. She had the palest blonde hair. It fell heavily to her shoulders, unfashionably long. Her eyes were deep blue against a lightly sunburned skin, and her mouth was bold and generous, and would have a lovely smile. She stood up and took her hand away from her mouth. She was tall, perhaps 5 feet 10, and her arms and legs looked firm as if she might be a swimmer, her breasts thrust against the black silk of the brassiere. Some of the fear had gone out of her eyes. She said in a low voice,
"What are you going to do?"
"Nothing to you. I may tease Goldfinger a bit. Move over like a good girl and let me have a look." Bond took the girl's place and looked through the glasses. The game was going on normally. Goldfinger showed no sign that his communications had broken down. "Doesn't he mind not getting the signals? Will he stop playing?" She said hesitatingly,
"It's happened before when a plug pulled or something. He just waits for me to come through again."
Bond smiled at her. "Well, let's let him stew for a bit. Have a cigarette and relax." He held out a packet of Chesterfields. She took one. "Anyway, it's time you did the nails on your right hand." A smile flickered across her mouth.
"How long were you there? You gave me a frightful shock."
"Not long, and I'm sorry about the shock. Goldfinger's been giving poor old Mr. DuPont shocks for a whole week."
"Yes,"
she said doubtfully.
"I suppose it's really rather mean. But he's very rich, isn't he?"
"Oh, yes. I shouldn't lose any sleep over Mr. DuPont. But Goldfinger might choose someone who can't afford it. Anyway, he's a zillionaire himself. Why does he do it? He's crawling with money." This book is continued on